The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
There's two concussion-related stories around today that we want to merge together and talk about now. One of them is to do with these flashing mouthguards that you might see at the Rugby World Cup, the Women's Rugby World Cup. It's getting underway Friday week. Ireland are out, I think, on Saturday afternoon in Northampton Stadium against Japan in their first game. But some of the players are going to be wearing these flashing LED mouthguards that will light up when players suffer a significant head impact during a match. And this is to deal with the issue of concussion. Then on the front of the Irish Daily Mail today, I was reading a research carried out from UCC that showed just how many school-age rugby players, fellas in secondary school, most of them, it has to be said, will continue playing through concussion and will do what they can to hide the impact of concussion or the fact that they're going through it. So Colin Doherty is with me. He's a professor of neurology at Trinity and a consultant neurologist at St James's as well. Colin, you're very welcome and thanks a million for coming into us. In terms of the mouthguards themselves, I know you guys, in terms of the research, were involved very early on in this, and you were telling me you were looking at MMA initially, and it's now been broadened out to two other sports. It speaks to the need to do something about concussion. Is that fair?
Oh, it's absolutely fair. Yeah. And, our evaluation of this technology early on suggested that really the mouthguard is the only sensor that can really detect concussion. So there are basically sensors put behind the ear. You know, there are sensors put on the forehead or in headbands. Really, they're no good because of the skin movement. So the fact that the mouthguard is locked into the jaw, which is part of the skull, is really the only place you can make a reliable measure of G-forces.
And that's what it's measuring, the G-force of an impact.
Yeah.
And so it lights up. And when it lights up, is that evidence in and of itself of a concussion, or is that just indicative of a possible concussion and then investigations are carried out?
Yeah, so there's a bit of terminology we have to clear up here. So first of all, a concussion, generally we mean a biomechanical force that induces a symptom.
Yeah.
Or something visible about the player, you know, confusion, disorientation, obviously getting knocked out is the biggest example. And somebody putting their hand up to say, I don't feel right. So that's a concussion. Everything else is a subconcussive blow. Right, so everything else that doesn't cause the person to feel symptoms is below a concussion. Okay, so the question is, what's the G-force that dictates a concussion? The likelihood is it's very different for different people. And we already know that women and men probably suffer concussions at different levels. And there are various biological reasons for that. And I reckon it's not dictated in the materials that I read here, but probably the G-force of 60 Gs is the point at which it'll light up. So the average force of a tackle in rugby is about 20 Gs. Mm. And to put that in context, you know, if you crash a car into a wall at 35 kilometres an hour, you suffer about a 35 G force. So a 20 Gs is the average blow in rugby. It's pretty significant.
Yeah.
Right? So at 60, it probably lights up, which tells the ref there's a HIA, regardless of whether the person feels the symptom or not. And so that's not a concussion per se, but it might remove the player from the field. And I don't know how they're integrating that data with the so-called head assessment, HIA, because that, in my view, is a very, very suspect test, because we know that people may not manifest the symptoms for minutes to hours after a blow to the head, and particularly young people. So I'm not sure what the calculation will be, but it's certainly a move in the right direction. And I think it's at least measuring the forces that the person's really undergoing.
We'll stick with that analogy, a move in the right direction. How early are we still on that journey in terms of getting to a place where neurologists like yourself would be happy with the protocols of the protections in place? Or in other words, I'll kind of flip the question on its head and ask it another way. How worried are you when you watch rugby the way it's played or other sports like that, be it MMA or anything else, about head injuries, concussions, or anything else?
Well, just let me inoculate these comments, but I'm not a person that wants to see the sport denuded or banned or anything like that. My son played schools rugby at a very high level. I do watch it now and I cringe at the power that I see and I wince. And nobody who cares about player welfare doesn't wince now at rugby games. So I think we're very, very far, unfortunately, from making this a safer game. Is this a, you know, it's a step in the right direction. We're measuring the forces. To be honest, I've come full circle on this. I used to be of the opinion that this is only going to be solved when the codes get their act together and, you know, really take player welfare seriously and all that sort of stuff. I now believe that they can't do it on their own. And I genuinely believe that there's a public health aspect to this. There's an obligation on behalf of government, Department of Sport, Department of Health, take seriously the idea that they're responsible for the brain health of young people. I mean, this data on the young men, you know, ignoring the protocols. Yeah. Like, this is why young men go to war, right? Nobody would go to war who didn't have an immature brain and acted impulsively.
Yeah.
We're not putting this at the kids' feet.
Yeah.
And no amount of education is going to change their view in a final that they're going to play through.
Absolutely not.
So this is not put at their feet.
Yeah.
But I want to take something particularly important and relate to the political thing here. Whatever it is about adults who make a decision to play a dangerous game, some of them do motocross, some of them climb up sheer cliff faces without a net. People who are adults make their own decision to do dangerous things. Up to the age of 18, okay, that decision is being made by somebody, either the parent or somebody acting in loco parentis, a coach on the sideline who's making a judgment that this is a safe game and this is a safe sport for this person to participate in. How confident are we that that's the case? I'm not confident at all that the people on the sidelines know the risks associated with it. For instance, a lot of coaches think that wearing, headgear is somehow
the scrum caps.
Yeah, it's not. There's loads of research to show not only is it not protective, it's actually worse than useless. Because
why?
Because what happens is if you give that to a 17-year-old and say, "Look, that'll protect your head. I want you to wear that. That'll protect your head." They change the behaviour. They go lower in tackles. They use their head in tackles in a way they wouldn't do.
Mm.
Like, I always say this to people about American football. These big guys wear crash helmets. And the concussion epidemic in American football is off the charts. And they're spending billions of dollars on helmet technology to try and fix it.
Mm.
But if you wanted to fix American football tomorrow, you just remove the helmets. People would start protecting their heads and it would be a much safer game. It'd be a different game. But a much safer game. So my real issue here is professionals, people who get paid a lot of money to do dangerous things, that's their decision. In the schools, we are acting in loco parentis. We, the parents, the coaches, the people who run the clubs, and we don't have the information about risk. We don't understand the dangers. This technology is expensive. It's not going to be given out to schools anytime soon. You know, when I say to people, when you see this...
So then what's the solution for schools? If we accept the reality that young lads are young lads, and we were both young lads, and to be honest, I'd have tried to hide it. I would have been. I have a match next week and I'm absolutely playing it. And we're not going to see this level of technology in the kind of Leinster, Munster, whatever it happens to be, Senior Schools Cup in the next few years. How do we protect those kids?
Well, as I said, when I say the word, there's a public health issue, I'm talking about a policy decision to sanction people who don't follow guidance that you would give for safe, effective play. So, for instance, right, why isn't it true that all coaches who are on the sidelines, who are often parents themselves, and fair play to them, they're giving up their time, should actually be trained in concussion recognition and in assessing risk and in a very simple assessment of whether somebody's injured or not? Why not? Why isn't it that there's a register when people have a head injury? We have 400,000 young people playing contact sports every weekend in Ireland. Just how many of those people are getting blows to the head where they're getting concussed and nobody really knows what to do? I mean, I've been at these games. I've been at these games where the coach says, well, I don't really know what to do. And the other thing that's important, like, people think of concussion as this kind of, you know, multi-camera angle, slow motion event where they watch it over and over again in a professional game. What's going on is field number 5, miles away, there's about 8 parents watching the game and little Johnny gets laid out and everybody goes, what happened? Did anybody see what happened? And nobody saw what happened.
Yeah.
So we're not, that is what's happening. That is the vast majority of concussion, not what you're seeing in the professional game. So regulation, training, education and sanctions for people who don't follow those, like, they are not, in my view, doing anything to denude the game, but they are placing an obligation on clubs and the codes to follow a public health guidance. This is a public health issue. Brain injury is at epidemic proportions. There's 2,000 people admitted to James's every year with a brain injury. And actually, most of them are not sports. People are getting assaulted, they're getting road traffic accidents.
Yeah.
So we've got a massive concussion brain injury epidemic. All of the big urban hospitals are the same. And we have no regulation. In the place where we could prevent it, right? Sports, we're doing nothing. We're putting all of the obligation on the codes. And they're doing their best. And this is a step in the right direction. But I really genuinely believe that the codes themselves cannot do it. It's like asking, the auto industry to take all the responsibility for car safety.
Yeah.
Imagine the government said, it's all up to you. We're not fixing the roads. We're not making laws about seatbelts. We're not putting any social pressure to reduce drinking. You have to do it all.
It's social media companies. We're doing that at the moment. There's a whole other discussion, but it's the kind of please sign up to these voluntary codes and protect our kids. You know what I mean? But it reminds me, because the sport I'd be more familiar with it with GAA, while I was playing, the change happened that introduced compulsory helmets. And actually, it was partly internal, but actually it was external. Now, it wasn't government policy or anything like that or regulation, but it was insurance. The insurance industry saying, you guys have a problem. And I played in a match where somebody lost an eye, and they turned around and they said, we are going to have a problem providing insurance to the GAA and to individual clubs if people are not wearing protective gear that's available to everybody at a reasonable price. And that's actually what mandated the change. It was dressed up in, we're really worried about player welfare. Yeah. And look, they were. I'm not kind of being dismissive of that. But it was mandated from the outside. Yeah.
Whatever the incentives are, you know, I mean, I do think that government involvement, an acknowledgement by sport and health that we are in this space and we are responsible for protecting brains. Like, for instance, a lot of people think about this long-term problem with brain health as being affecting people in their 50s and 60s. Mm. And certainly, we now know this is probably an underestimate, but at least 15% of the burden of dementia is related to brain injury.
Mm.
That's a huge amount, and hugely costly, by the way. Not just a tragedy for the families who have people who have dementia. But the reality is that we now know, and I'll tell you some startling data, that this is also happening in younger people. Okay, so Anne McGee, who is the pathologist in Boston who runs the Boston Brain Bank, did a study of 130 young athletes under 30 who died. Okay. They were athletes and they died primarily of what? What would you say they died? What was the commonest cause of death?
I would say suicide.
Suicide. Okay. Which is potentially linked here, right? So heaviest cause, suicide. They looked at their brains. 40% of them had evidence of CTE. These were all under 30. Now, you know, somebody says to me, sure, I played rugby till I was, 45, and here I am now, a pundit. Yeah. And, that's like saying my Uncle Joe smoked 20 major for 80 years and he's still alive. We still don't know what it is about make somebody get lung cancer when they smoke.
Yeah.
So if we knew that, we'd just say, you're
But also, it's different. Like people who played the game 40 years ago, they're bigger, they're stronger. The physical impact is
no
different.
No question.
And that goes all the way down. That it doesn't precipitate maybe down to the kids level yet, but it's certainly at schoolboy and schoolgirl level. And that's across all sports. They're all bigger, they're all stronger, and they're all hitting each other with much more force.
Yeah. And that's why there is an advocacy group forming at the moment of older players, led by a very famous Irish player called Mick Malloy, who's a doctor, was the Irish doctor for 15 years, played British and Irish Lions and the Irish team. And it represents a group of ex-players who now feel that the game is too dangerous. They're lovers of the game. They do not want it banned. They don't want it radically changed, but they want it made safer. And that seems to be a very reasonable question. But I really do think that this, having come at this advocacy for many, many years, that unless public health gets involved, unless the government cedes its responsibility, why can't we have an agency for brain injury, brain health, that's similar to road safety authority, like a brain safety authority, which says you have to be licensed, you have to be trained, you have to be educated, you have to keep data. I mean, why can't we do that? What is, I know it's going to cost money.
Yeah.
But the question is, if you take all those people who are developing brain health problems, and it's not just dementia, right? We now know that in midlife, neuropsychiatric problems, suicide and depression, anxiety and addiction are all part of the outcomes of some of these people. And I just want this to happen. I will not have all the answers. I won't be the guy making all those rules. I'd be happy to be part of an expert group, but it needs to be everybody working together, and it needs government regulation.
Colin, thanks a million for coming in to us. Colin Doherty, who's a professor of neurology at Trinity and a consultant neurologist at St. James's as well.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.